welcome to
the Plant-Based Podcast.
In case you didn't know already, plants are amazing. You can
eat them,
wear them,
drink them,
nourish your skin with them,
grow them,
love them,
and be inspired by them. So why not join us on the Plant-Based Podcast as we speak to the movers, shakers, and growers in this amazing plant world.
This episode of the Plant-Based Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Natural Grower. Launched in 2019, their award-winning liquid fertilizer and soil conditioner is made entirely from maize. Visit naturalgrower.co.uk to nurture your soil and boost your plants and veg. Enter PBP15 for a 15% discount as a PBP subscriber.
So on today's podcast, our guest is award-winning freelance photojournalist, writer and filmmaker, Lalagi Snow, who explores gardens tended to by civilians searching for peace and calm who are caught up in conflict. So from the Middle East and Afghanistan, plus other areas, which we will find out more about during this podcast. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really exciting.
And we know that there's a very new baby in the background as well. So massive congratulations for that too.
Thank you.
If anyone hears any crying in the background, that's why. Just a couple of weeks old. But yeah, I get. Thank you so much for joining us. I know this is we're doing our usual during the pandemic. We're using Zoom to record our podcasts. So. Michael and I, as we always kind of joke about, we send signals to each other so everyone knows what they're doing. And I sometimes so wish that our listeners could see what that looks like, because it looks ridiculous sometimes.
Like a very bad Macarena.
It really is. Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, so, you know, what you do, what I've looked at so far, just looks absolutely extraordinary. And I really think our listeners are going to thoroughly enjoy hearing about how important gardening is for people all around the world, and especially in conflict. So I really can't wait to get started.
Great.
Absolutely. So I first came across Lalagi's interview with Monocle, and that was all around the subject of war gardens, because she's literally just released a book a few months ago. But we want to go back a little bit further than that. So tell us about your background. Where did you grow up, and did you have any interest in plants and gardening at that young age? And then what came next?
Funnily enough, not remotely. The first 10 years of my life were they're quite peripatetic. I moved around a lot. My father was in the army, and then he wasn't. We moved in. We were in London, Northern Ireland, Germany, Hong Kong, a bit in France. And it actually gave me more of a sense of what home is, but wasn't really interested in plants, but in the outdoors, definitely. And I think, my mother was a very keen gardener, and in various houses that we moved to, I do have the strong memories of walking around the garden with her, looking at her while she was pruning the roses or the nepeta or the lavender or whatever it was. And I think I had a very strong affinity with being outside. I hate being cooped up inside. So this pandemic is horrendous, even though, well, I have a garden, but it's not nice. And then I think I was at school in London. Again, we had a holiday home in France, and I was always out in the woods or running through fields or just being outside. And then I had a sort of long-winded route into journalism via, I had a peripatetic early 20s and moved to, I was in Southeast Asia, in Bangladesh, I was in South America, in Argentina, just working and traveling, and worked in Jordan for an art and fashion magazine, and traveled a lot in the Middle East. This is way before anything happened. This is in the early 2000s, so I was in Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, and I think, again, I was sort of in some of these very extreme places where you feel quite isolated and quite, you're kind of at the extremes of your comfort zone. You do search for things that bring you home or that make you feel comfortable, whether that is stars in the sky or a familiar smell or familiar food. You know, when we're on holiday in you know, Greece, you would sort of see restaurants selling ham, egg and chips, or English, you know, restaurants, the English sort of style menus. And I think in a funny way, I started to look at the outside world as something to find my roots, something to ground me. And I think that's sort of where it sort of started from. And you know, by and large, long-winded route into basically living in Afghanistan as a foreign correspondent, freelancer, and finding out that actually Afghans that have a huge affinity with gardens too. And there's something, again, is when you're in these very hostile places, because when I was working as before Afghanistan, I was in the Middle East, not for this fashion magazine, but for my own kind of freelance war correspondences, and finding out that actually when you do find common ground with people, when you're trying to find a common theme, often the outside world and gardens is a really good sort of a starting point. And I just have this very vivid memory of being in Gaza and seeing this wall over around a private garden and this bougainvillea foaming over the top of it, and thinking, mm-hmm. Oh gosh, there's a real little domestic square behind there. And Gaza is a very difficult place to live, and it was riddled with conflict, etc. And thinking, oh, there's probably, like, you know, a family behind there with toys and pots full of cacti and obviously a bougainvillea plant. And there was something very grounding. And I think that's really, I first started to realise that plants are a great equaliser. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, there are plants, more or less. And that's sort of where this started from.
It's fascinating. I mean, you've moved around a lot and seen so much of the world, you know, during various stages of peace and war. And you were obviously working as a foreign correspondent. Is that what your main role was while you were traveling?
Well, in my early 20s, I was doing lots of different things, but a journalist, basically, a photographer. I was doing travel pieces, art. I was an art editor for a magazine in the Middle East. And I loved being in different places. I was very used to it and pushing boundaries, and loved the idea of being in a foreign place. But then when you do feel a bit isolated, you know, you look for the common ground, and you find that in plants. A geranium is a geranium, whether you're in Dorset, where I live now, or in the middle of Kabul. It's the same leaf, the same smell, the same stems, and you think, oh, there we go.
Absolutely. I just have to just ask you the question. So did you say that you settled in Afghanistan? That's where you settled for a little while? Is that what you...
I did. I'd worked there I'd embedded with the military as a photographer, actually when I was a photography student, and then went back. That was in 2007. And I went back to do a story in 2010 for The Telegraph in Kabul, in the capital, and met all these amazing, weird and wonderful people who are still my best friends today, who are working out there too, and decided actually Kabul was not what you think it would be, and it'd be a great tight place to kind of base yourself as a foreign correspondent. So I did that I worked there for 10 years in total, and I lived there for about 5 or 6, okay. One off, 7 maybe.
I had a friend who also lived in Kabul, and how she describes it as a place before conflict was just very beautiful, very colourful, very kind of cosmopolitan. And it's very hard for us to picture that because we really only see the photographs of conflict. And is that right? Is that how you remember Kabul to be?
Definitely. And actually, even during conflict, I think even as an expat, or as a middle-class Afghan, I suppose, you have your domestic space. Everything's behind your walled your wall, basically, in your compound, and you have a garden, and you can actually live quite a nice existence. It's very much a bubble because it's not really. It's very different for real Afghans. But I think when you look back at photographs from the 60s, 70s, and the 19th century, it's extraordinary the level of, they had a reformer, King Amanullah Khan, in the 1920s, and he very much sort of instigated this European style of dressing and building. And you look at photographs before the Civil War, and it's remarkable. You have these sort of it almost looks like bits of Berlin in places, and sort of semi-neoclassical bits of architecture that come out of some monument somewhere. And then obviously quite brutalist architecture from the from the 60s and 70s. And then obviously latterly from Soviet influences, big high-rise buildings. But very, very different to what you'd expect. But of course, war for us, you know, as Brits, it was primarily focused in Helmand, which is a totally different world to Kabul. Helmand is it's off the spectrum. It's a desert. It's dusty. It's sandy. The villages and the town, the capital of Helmand province is a town called Lashkargah that was built by the Americans. So it's on a grid structure and quite low lying. It's quite fertile down there because you have the Helmand River. And different kinds of plants that grow there, and again gardens, but a totally, totally different world to Kabul city. And you get people in Kabul who are, you know, I was speaking to some women in a shelter once when I was doing a story, and the week after I was going to Helmand to do some military stuff, and they were like, "Oh, why would you go to Helmand? It's horrible down there. It's a basket case." Even some Kabulis would laugh at the idea of going to Helmand. Very different to how we.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear about these things from the other side, because it's not quite as it appears sometimes. And, you know, normal life does, you know, go on while a lot of this stuff is happening. So when you first started to put your book together, where did that seed of an idea come from? And how did you then start to put that together? Because you've obviously covered Afghanistan in there, but also Israel, a few different countries, Ukraine as well, I believe.
Well, it was actually through living in Kabul at this time. And I think about 2012 it was, the Arab Spring had happened the year before. And the news agenda was very much moving away from Afghanistan. And it made me really sad because our soldiers were still dying, American, European, whatever soldiers, Afghan soldiers were still being killed in their droves. Civilians were, you know, being killed. There were bomb blasts going off, but people didn't care because it was inconvenient, you know. And at the time, the news agenda was very, very consciously moving away from Afghanistan. I ended up working for NATO for a short period of time doing propaganda when I was very, very cash strapped. Mm-hmm. And there was a directive that came directly from 10 Downing Street, which basically was like, we need Afghanistan to go away. So I know from the top, it was, this is an embarrassing war that we're losing. The news needs to veer away from it. Anyway, it made me really sad because all these tragedies were still happening and no one cared. And I thought, well, if no one cares about the really brutal stuff that's happening, but people care about the soft stuff, why not try and re-narrate war and take war back into people's living rooms, drawing rooms, whatever, their kitchen tables on Sundays, through something peaceful and counterintuitive, which they might identify with, which is gardens. And, you know, being in Afghanistan, seeing these gardens everywhere, and Afghans do love to garden. They are amazing gardeners and they have their hands in the soil, and it's extreme. You have nurseries at the side of the roads going off into the badlands of the Hindu Kush mountains, literally little old men selling geraniums, cosmos, black eyed Susans, all those sorts of things. And so I just thought, well, why not try and retell the story of Afghanistan through a series of portraits of gardeners and gardens, but very much in the own words, in their own words of what it's like to be an Afghan living in a war zone, in Afghanistan, having lived through 30 odd years of war. And the way I work as a photographer is very much to, I use text a lot. I think it's, I don't like taking people's photograph without knowing pretty much what they had for breakfast, because I like to give that sense of, and I think it's important that people look at a photograph knowing who they're looking at and why they're looking at them. So that's really where it started. And it was great fun. It was a real balm and tonic for myself, because I was not having a great time. I was witnessing lots of quite brutal, nasty things, of everything from child abuse to people being blown up. And you become very immune to it quite quickly, but actually it's not normal to see things like that and to be immune. It's not great to see a foot in a piece of razor wire from a suicide bomber and think, oh well, that's odd. So I think I started to sort of try and photograph and take myself out of that world as well, and to flip into a much more cozy domestic world and a positive world of gardening, but still keeping my roots, as it were, in the foundation of the conflict, i.e. the people who are actually having to live through it. because all very well for people like me to come and go, you know, we've got tons of pots of money compared to a local Afghan, just get a visa, fly in, fly out, have a jolly, get pissed at an embassy bar. But for Afghans, it's not like that. And so that's really where it started. And having worked in the Middle East, I started to realize that land means so much to so many in different conflict zones in very nuanced ways. And in Gaza and the West Bank and Israel, land very much is at the core of the conflict. It's very much, you know, this is our ancestral land. We belong here. It doesn't matter which side you speak to. Mm-hmm. And then later I went to Ukraine. I was speaking to a friend who worked as a correspondent there. And he said, oh, God, the Ukrainians are crazy about their gardens too. But for, again, for a very different reason, they're much more of a self-sufficient society. Well, in rural Ukraine, it's more about living off your land. It goes back to pre-communist Soviet era style gardening of there aren't vegetables in the market, so let's grow them kind of thing. And with the advent of the war there, people started to go back to growing their own vegetables, and it was a return to sort of more organic or more useful way of gardening, I suppose. And that's basically, this is a long-winded answer, but that's kind of how it started. And the more, funny enough, I actually wanted to go to many, many different countries because I know that there are amazing gardens in Kashmir, and that's a war that has, you know, it's obviously, it blew up last year, but it goes on. There's an area of Azerbaijan and Armenia called Nagorno-Karabakh, which means, I think the actual word in one of the languages means black garden or black soil. And that's, again, to do, it's a turf war. And they have amazing gardens there. And then the Central African Republic, there are all sorts of weird and wonderful gardens there. And every conflict that you look at, there are people trying to get by and survive. But no one really cares because, at the end of the day, sometimes when you're reading your Sunday newspaper or your Saturday magazines, whatever it is, you kind of gloss over it. Oh, it's happening to other people. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect me. But actually, it should, because it's a tragedy that these wars are still going on. Mm. And I'm waffling now.
it's all good. It's so interesting. Yeah. And what kind of just stood out from what you were just saying there was that this kind of project, your book, it was also a form of escapism and therapy for you, because you were equally in that conflict zone, seeing things that, like you just mentioned, were become normal, but they shouldn't be normal. So you used this for you, as well as being able to take your journalism skills and knowledge to, you know, do something very different to what was being reported, and trying to make people connect with people who were in war zones. So, and that's exactly what gardening and plants can do. It connects people. It doesn't matter where you're from, what situation you're in. Plants and gardening are, as you've said many times, the commonality between all people. Mm. So, that just shows, you know, with what you've just said. So, there was a couple of times that you mentioned there that people in different areas had been using gardening to try to be self-sufficient, or to produce food because it wasn't available on the market, and so on. You've obviously used it as a bit of escapism, which I guess I would expect many people in conflict zones had also been doing. Do you really see kind of like a main reason why people garden across every area that you've been to? Is there one kind of common reason why people enjoy plants and gardening?
No, definitely not. And for the same reason that there isn't a common reason why people enjoy gardening and planting in times of peace, because people do it for different reasons. I think it's quite relevant now in these pandemic days, because it's something to do, and it's a way of escaping the boredom, I think, of being in a pandemic. But I think, and across different conflicts, people were gardening in different ways. So in Ukraine, people were much more inclined towards being self-sufficient and growing vegetables to live off. And because in Ukraine, when these imports, the supermarkets started to shut, and the imports from China and Russia that people have been so dependent on started to dwindle, people began to grow their own vegetables again. But in Gaza, which is a much more sort of it's a much more urban and built up place. It's in a hugely densely populated area of land. Of I think the density is of the UK is 250 people per square kilometre, and in Gaza it's something like 4,500. I'm sure those figures are wrong, but it's up there, and it's very, very dense populated. People garden there for peace and for returning to the old ways of what their parents' generation used to do. A lot of older Gazans remember a time where Israelis and Palestinians used to pretty much live and work side by side and hand in hand, quite happily in the rural southern areas. And I think in Afghanistan, it's just, for Afghans to garden, it's sort of second nature. And it doesn't matter if you're speaking to a warlord or to a poor man. Having to grow something is part of, it's like breathing. So very different ways. There are very different reasons for gardening. I mean, equally in the West Bank, for both the settlers and the Palestinian villagers, gardening and cultivation of land was part of the struggle. And so I'd speak to people in legal settlements all over the West Bank, and they'd talk about putting their roots down because the land was infertile before we came here to recolonize or I think people were using the idea of land cultivation as part of the conflict, basically. So very different reasons.
Okay, and what would be some of the standout stories from some of those places you were? I remember coming to your talk at the Chelsea Physics and in particular, there was on the Gaza Strip, this woman that was still gardening, despite stones being thrown at the property. There was also this guy in Afghanistan, the really young guy as well. So can you give us a couple of examples of stories that really touched your heart in particular?
Sure. There was, it was in the West Bank. There was in Hebron, and the West Bank's a really, really complex place, which is, yeah. I don't think time will allow me to go into here, but Hebron is a city that's basically been divided into, you know, the Palestinians and the Israelis, and it's really hard for the Palestinians living there. They've been very, 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 very marginalised, and the woman I interviewed was called Zleika, and she was a nursery school teacher and a tour guide, because Hebron is a very ancient city, mm-hmm. and she spoke very good English, but she had no work, obviously, because no one was going for tourism there. And she had a balcony overlooking one of the main roads called Al-Shahada Street that had been completely blocked up, blocked by the Israelis. So in order to access her front door, well, she couldn't because it was on the road that was forbidden for any Palestinians to go down. She had to go through the series of networks through the old city, through balconies and over people's not quite back garden, but cross walls and through little tiny holes, mm-hmm. to get to her house. And she had a little patch of a yard courtyard on a roof, and she also had a balcony. And her balcony had been, I thought she'd caged herself in, mm-hmm. but actually she was caging out the people, the settlers, who would stand in the street beneath her and throw rocks at her. And when the street was first cut off and she didn't have a cage around her balcony, she found people crawling up the walls, trying to get into her apartment, trying to assault her, and, you know, obviously throwing huge insults. And she's a, you know, 50-year-old respectable lady. It's not a nice thing to do. But she continued to garden and to grow in full sight, in plain sight of not only the very, very fanatic settlers of Hebron, but also the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, who would tell her to go inside, because she said, "No, this is showing them that I'm not beaten. You can't beat me." And she had, you know, quite scrappy cacti and a few spider plants, but she'd go out there every day and water her plants. Wow. And it was just, she was just very inspiring, because she wasn't going to give up, and she continued to teach gardening and seed planting to some of the nursery school children that she was working with, because she knew that they also suffered huge amounts of trauma from living in Hebron, and that they could maintain some level of sanity by growing things. And then in Afghanistan, I've interviewed over 120, 130 people for War Gardens. So there are many, many examples. But there was one of my youngest gardeners was a young chap in Afghanistan called Hamidullah, who was 19 when I met him. So he's now 20. 23, and he was a pharmacology student. He was brought up as a refugee in Iran, like many young Afghans. And Afghans living in Iran aren't treated very well because they're sort of the migrant population, and they're the third-class citizens, if they're citizens at all. And when he returned with his family to Afghanistan, when Hamid Karzai was put in power and Taliban were thrown away, he went back to his family land, which had been all but sort of destroyed by years of war and unrest. And his father, who was a keen gardener, gave him a plant to plant. It was a wallflower. And he said, you know, quote unquote, "From there, my love of gardening grew." And his garden was, it was more like a country garden. So it was quite cottagey in feeling. And there was water, a stream at the bottom, and there was like a meadow area, and there were trees of walnuts and almonds and some other kind of nut, apricots. It was such a beautiful, beautiful place to be. And then he had a sort of formal bit around the house, which was pots full of geraniums and roses and a vine-covered pergola and all these lovely, recognisable, almost Mediterranean feel garden sort of planting style to them. And as we were sort of, I didn't quite believe that he was, there's a funny thing about working in Afghanistan, there's a level of trust that sometimes you think, are the Afghans just, the people you're interviewing, are they just saying what you want to hear because they're being polite? That's it's a cultural thing. Or is there something genuine going on here? And it can be frustrating at the same time because you're talking through an interpreter. And so you don't have the same fluidity of conversation. You don't pick up on nuances that you do in communication that you do in your own language. But I sensed that there was something going on with this guy, but I was trying to get to the bottom of it. And then he basically ended up, after sort of much probing, said, actually, you know, when one of his best mates was a soldier in the Afghan army, and he was killed in a suicide bombing about a year ago, so four years ago, and they were as close as brothers. And so when he died, he was so devastated he couldn't sleep for grief. And these are his words, really. I know them verbatim now, but he said, "I was so sad I couldn't sleep for grief, and I started a garden in order to forget." And when he planted a geranium, I think. Yeah. And when the flowers grew, it was like he had a new friend. And it was a really, really touching story. And he welled up when he was telling me. And when he was studying, and he was a very hard worker, and he studied in his greenhouse. And again, I didn't believe him. And he actually took me and showed me. And he had this geranium on his little desk next to his pharmacology notes. And it was a really, really touching story, because there was me being the cynic, being like, oh, they're just going to tell me what I want to hear. And actually, no, he was genuinely really loved his planting and his gardening. And I felt like a bit of a fool. but that story was, you know, that story happens in so many places. There was a lady, another settler I met in outside Hebron, funnily enough, near Zlaika, whose son was killed by some Palestinians throwing rocks, and the garden became her solace because her son left behind a pregnant widow and a two-year-old, and she didn't know what to do with herself, and so her garden became this place of grief and mourning, but actually it also became gradually over time a place where she could live again. And it was as if I can't remember her words word for word, but it was something like, when I'm in my garden, I'm filled with light, and every other part of my day is darkness. It was something along those lines, because she could connect and deal with her grief through gardening. I think the amount of sort of times that I've talked about some of these people, and whether I'm at book festivals or garden talks or whatever, and people come up to me afterwards, and I think it really touches people, because it's again this common ground. And here are these people. There's a 19-year-old pharmacology student in the outskirts of Kabul, and an American Israeli settler on the outskirts of Hebron. And I can think of several more who have the same connectivity in southern Afghanistan, in eastern Ukraine, who are all gardening for those similar themed reasons. In the same token that you have people who are gardening for resistance, to show the opposition that, no, we're not beaten. You have that in Ukraine, you have that in Gaza, you have that with the Talibs in the south that I interviewed, who are gardening for the same reason, to show the Brits and the Americans that, no, we're not beaten, you've invaded our land, this is why we're going to fight you, this is our garden, our land.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it is totally fascinating. But, you know, whilst you've obviously, you've said that people in different areas garden perhaps for different reasons, but there is this commonality between all of us and plants and gardening. The one thing that kind of does strike me as you're talking through kind of all of these stories and what people are doing and why is that perhaps that plants and gardening and growing food is actually giving people hope. And is that how you see it in those situations? Is that kind of that intrinsic thing within people who are persistent in gardening and carrying on doing it in difficult situations? Is it all about hope, do you think?
I think a lot of it is, because if you think about it, gardening, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, gardening takes you out of the present and it puts you in the future, because you're gardening for the next season, you're gardening for the growth, you're gardening to see something happen. So it takes you out of whatever awful situation you might be in, which is, and I've since sort of come to realize in it's only latterly that I've become a very, very ropey gardener, I have to say. And I do struggle with being patient. But it is teaching me, especially now when I'm like, oh, it's this beautiful spring, I need to get out and go, I can't garden because I've just had a baby. I've got a one-year-old as well, so and it does take you out of, you know, just it makes me look forward to, okay, quarantine and this lockdown will end, and when it does end, there will be even more beautiful plants than there are now. And I think that's the same for people gardening in these times of war as well. It takes them out of, okay, we don't know when this war is going to end, but when it does, or even if it doesn't, in a few months' time, these plants will outlive any of this war rubbish that's going on. There was a shopkeeper I met in Gaza who was such a kind and gentle man, and he was he had a beautiful sort of square plot of land. It was very meticulously and delicately laid out. And it was very young, and he said that actually he had to rebuild it because after the last incursion from the Israelis, an F-17 or an F-7, whatever they're called, shell hit his garden, and basically it became a sand pit. And it was just a mound, a shell casing, basically, of earth. But the first thing he did when that happened, when he got back after, you know, the incursion was over, was to set about, right, re-leveling out his garden again. And I think it's that level of control as well, which gardening offers people when you're in this chaotic world. And I think Vita Sackville-West writes about it quite a lot in The Garden. And I think it's touched on in Milton in Paradise Lost. But it's that level of sort of control which, when the world is spiraling out of control and out of your control and out of your comfort zone, to garden is something that you can do yourself. And it's extraneous to everything outside that's happening. Mm-hmm.
I just want you to know I have tears in my eyes right now. I genuinely have tears in my eyes right now.
Well, you've got a baby too.
Yeah. I'm crying for you in quarantine with the two
people. I can't say this. These stories are just fascinating, and it's wonderful to have more detail on that and learn more about hope as well. I'm just wondering, have you kept in touch with any of those people that we've spoken about at all, like the guy in Afghan? I wonder what he's up to now.
I haven't kept in touch with, I've kept in touch with about two or three of them. Mm-hmm. Very, very loosely. It's very difficult to, I don't speak Hebrew, I don't speak Arabic. I mean, enough to make people think I do, which is basically, hi, how's it going? And then it gets awkward. But I don't speak Ukrainian. I speak a smattering of Dari, Persian, Farsi. So no, I know I can find them again and get in touch with them, if I want, especially some of the ones in Kabul. The Hamadullah, the pharmacology student, I believe that he was granted asylum and now lives in Germany, but I haven't been in touch with him at all. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
You know, the people who you've met and the stories that you've chosen to cover in your book, that's kind of keeping you close to them. Do you know that's keeping you in contact with them? You're putting stories out there for people to see and make that connection with, which is just incredibly thought-provoking and moving. And
there was this one thing that you just reminded me that there's the front cover of the book is a guy called Muhammad Kabir, and he's a very entertaining chap. He told me he was 105 years old, and he was one of my first gardeners I met in 2012. And that particular photograph on the front cover was really popular, and it's been the front cover of the book, it's been used on posters, it's been exhibited in various places, I've talked about it in university at MIT, it's been exhibited at the Garden Museum. And in my head, because his story was very entertaining, and he talked a lot about Kabul in the 20s and what it used to be like, and how there were elephants in the gardens, and he was just a very gregarious character, and he made good stories. And in my head, he became basically a really good friend of mine. And when I went back to Kabul in 2017 to make this film for the BBC, he was potentially going to be one of our characters. And of course, I'd only met him once, but in my head, I'd met him all the time. I'd like hung out with him. I'd written about him, and I'd spoken about him. And my fixer had found him, and he came to meet us. And we were sitting in a 4x4 on the side of a dusty road, and this old man comes up with his bicycle, and I'm like, Muhammad Kabir, oh my God, you know, there you are, how are you? And you have to be very deferential, and he's an elderly man and I'm a woman, so it's like, assalamu alaikum, blah, 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 hand touching your shoulders. And he had no idea who I was, and it was so embarrassing. And my fixer was trying to explain to him, he's like, oh, this is Lali, and she's come to interview you about your garden. He's like, oh, I don't have a garden anymore, it's been destroyed. Oh no, but you met before. And he's like, what, she wants to buy some plants? What?
Oh no.
He didn't get it. And I was like, and then he and my fixer, who's a really good friend is over time, and he said, sorry, it's a clock game. He said,
well, the baby might wake up. Oh no.
It's not, it doesn't keep the right time. And he said, oh no, she wants to interview you about your garden. And he didn't get it. And then in the end, I can't remember what I was going to say now. The clock distracted me. That's right. I told him, I said, oh, you know, I've spoken about you at university in America, and I've spoken about you at talks, and this is a picture of you that I took. He's like, okay, are you going to give me some money?
Yeah, you've made me famous. Now I want some money.
Pretty much. Oh, wow. So you know. But it was so awkward, because I was like, oh, I'm going to meet Muhammad Kabir, we're going to have a great chat. He had no idea who I was.
No, you just have some of the most amazing stories to tell, and you can really visualise what you're saying as well, which is, you know, I mean, I know obviously you're a photojournalist and you're, you know, you're an author, and that, I'm sure that's your amazing talent and knowledge all coming together. But the people who you're talking about, I can almost kind of picture them and where you are. And that's, I mean, it's just incredible. So just tell us a little bit about your book, the name, where people can get it from, and also where people can find you online as well.
The book is called War Gardens, A Journey Through Conflict in Search of Calm. It's available in paperback, hardback and Kindle on all the usual platforms. And you can watch the BBC film The Gardeners of Kabul at wargardens.org, and you can also buy prints there as well. And it's a book that is partly my journey through a departure from traditional journalism and war corresponding, but mostly it's a book about the people I met, these amazing gardeners who are just really ordinary people, like everyone listening to this podcast, who just want to get on with life and to just slightly be left alone, which people like me don't help with, but who just want to get on with their lives and to have some degree of normalcy. And gardening is their way of doing that. And hopefully, you know, it might encourage other people to think more freely or with less constraint about some of the countries where these wars are going on, because what we see on the news is only a very distilled version of how things really are. That's and true. As you said, Michael, you know, life does go on in these places. Mm-hmm. And people do have to go to school, go to shops, go and be lawyers or bankers or whatever, or school teachers, or go to hospitals, or whatever people want to do. That, you know, that life does go on during these times of crisis. And I think I've been thinking a lot when the lockdown first happened, and my husband and I both were in Afghanistan for a very long time, so we're sort of taking it with our stride. It's not, you just deal with it basically, because lockdown used to happen quite a lot. If you work for a big organization in Afghanistan, you might be on lockdown for a while and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to get on with it. And then you just think, well, actually it's worse for people who do live in these war zones, because they don't know when it's going to end. And I suppose even worse, doubly now, because if coronavirus hits places like Yemen and Afghanistan, then God knows what will happen. But yes, so roundabout way of saying, do go and read and buy War Gardens. It's had great reviews. and it's not just a book about gardening as well. It's about people. And you won't learn anything about gardening through it, by the way, either. But you will learn a lot about people and places.
And that's important. People and places bring plants and gardening together. That's the whole theme, is that commonality. And that's
exactly
incredibly important. And you're online as well. Are you on social media at all?
Oh, yeah, I am. I'm on Instagram. And my handle is Lalagi Snow. And I'm on Twitter, but I'm more of a lurker than a Twitterer.
I have stalked you very lightly on Instagram. So
sit there and judge people.
Well, we hope that you can enjoy your garden a little bit, even though you're impatient gardening teacher.
I've just been on one of the gardening websites actually looking at seedlings, but everything's sold out, so I'm like, damn it, I have to grow it from seed, and that means effort. I can't do it. So
maybe you should do, your next book should be a photo journal of you learning how to garden.
It's quite warlike. I think it's quite warlike to take a mattock to the soil and just hammer the ground.
It has been so interesting and just incredibly thought-provoking. So I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. I know that our listeners are going to just thoroughly enjoy this, because when you talk to somebody about being in those kind of conflict zones, and what you see and how you talk about it is so different to how it's portrayed in the media, that I think it just really, really gets you. Do you know what I mean? Like, my heart feels like you've got me this morning, you know. And I know you kind of mentioned, you know, the pandemic going on at the moment, but, you know, even yesterday I was moaning and groaning, you know, you have your ups and downs, good days, bad days. I was moaning about the fact that I'm stuck in and da da da. I mean that's just completely ridiculous, and this puts it in perspective so much, you know.
Well, but it's, you know, but we've only just started on lockdown, you know, so it's so new for us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, well, it's been a real delight chatting to you both. Real people, not small babies.
Yeah. Well, we're pleased to have taken you away for half an hour. Not babies, but I'm sure your baby is waiting for you now. Thank you so much.
Super.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye.
This episode of the Plant-Based Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Natural Grower. Launched in 2019, their award-winning liquid fertilizer and soil conditioner is made entirely from maize. Naturally rich in nitrogen, potash, phosphate, and other trace elements that plants and vegetables love, it is approved by the Soil Association, Vegan Society, and Organic Farmers and Growers. Visit naturalgrower.co.uk to nurture your soil and boost your plants and veg. Enter PBP15 for a 15% discount as a PBP subscriber.
Thanks for listening. You should now be at least 25% more obsessed by plants.
Please follow us on social media. You'll find us by typing in the Plant-Based Podcast.
We also have a fabulous website. Go to theplantbasedpodcast.net.
So tell your friends, leave a review. Why not write a letter to your local MP? Please spread the word about the Plant-Based Podcast.
Oh yes, see you next time, plant friends.